Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance here. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. We are live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650. Is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now joining us from Sportsnet's NHL coverage, former NHL scout. He is live from Las Vegas, getting ready to be a part of Sportsnet's coverage of the NHL draft that gets going on Friday. He is our guy, Jason Bukala. Jason, thank you for doing this, man. How are you?
Fantastic, guys. Boiling hot down here. It'll definitely be a cab ride 100 meters to Sphere. It won't be walking distance, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Well, Drance was supposed to be there, but he's laid up with an ankle injury, so he couldn't make it.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mangled. No. I nuked my ankle on a desert hike, Books, and knowing that the Sphere was not going to be a conventional draft and that I'd probably have to walk, especially because all the blocks in Vegas are so long. Wasn't recommended.
Oh, buddy.
I know.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Me too.
That's tough. Yeah.
Okay, before we get to draft stuff and, you know, looking ahead to what could happen in Vegas at the draft, both, you know, with teams picking players, but trades and all of that as well. Obviously, you know, our first chance to talk since the Panthers clinched the Stanley Cup on Monday with the big Game 7 win. Of course, you've worked in that franchise before. What was your reaction seeing them get the job done and lift the Stanley Cup on Monday?
Well, obviously very excited for a lot of people there that I worked with for many, many years. You know, Brian McCabe for my whole time there almost. And then, you know, a lot of people behind the scenes like Braden Birch, who, you know, director of hockey operations, some of the scouting staff that still remain from my time there. But, you know, most importantly, it's pretty proud moment to see, you know, Barkov hoist the cup, and you know Ekblad and Bobrovsky, you know, guys that that were still on the roster that we had our fingerprints on. You know, that's a proud moment. I'm happy for them. I'm happy for the whole organization. So it was fun to see.
When you think about what put the Panthers over the top, right? The team level defense in particular. Just how much better constructed it felt like their roster was at the end of the day than the Oilers, even though there was no answer for McDavid, hard as Barkov tried. What lessons do you think NHL hockey operations groups around the league should take from this Panthers Stanley Cup victory?
Well, I think that the buy-in from top to bottom was so consistent, and that's something that like you didn't. Every time somebody rolled over the boards, the buy-in was, they mirrored each other. You know what I mean? So in the defensive zone, there was rarely, when you're following the puck around, there was rarely a time in the game that you didn't see five red sweaters, you know, in the zone, like in the shot on TV, if you will, because they were so dialed in defensively, and they swarmed, you know, the Oilers as best they could. And even when they, you know, pucks cut through the net in the third period, it got hectic. I mean, that was just fun to watch. It was just chaos. But I think more importantly, you know, they played to their strengths. And when they got a lead, they're just super, super hard to play against. They grind it along the wall. They wear you down physically and mentally. And I think that's the thing that stands out the most. You know, it was next man up all the time for the Panthers, even when the Oilers won three in a row. You know, they found a way in Game 7 to have that mentality rise to the occasion, and that's what stands out the most, the all-for-one, one-for-all type of thing.
Yeah, I thought we saw that definitely, I mean, all year with the Panthers and their defensive effort, but especially in Game 7 with some of the key defensive plays they made as well. All right, looking ahead to the draft that gets going on Friday and then rounds 2 through 7 on Saturday. We all know who's going number one. Macklin Celebrini is going to the San Jose Sharks. I think the intrigue starts after that. Who's the number two? I'll start with this. Who should be the second name called, in your view, on Friday?
Demidov should go too, but you're absolutely right. It's going to be very interesting because Chicago made that trade with the New York Islanders ahead of the draft to move up two slots from 20 to 18, which tells me they're very comfortable in targeting somebody at 18. And I believe that that's a forward. That's I'm not an insider, but I'm just looking around at names and hearing what I'm hearing, you know, strategically by, you know, just by running into colleagues. So I think that they're going to target a forward at 18, which might mean they go to Levchinov at two. And, but in my mind, best player on the board is Demidov, and I would call his name, and I would be very excited rolling out Connor Bedard and Ivan Demidov for the next several years in Chicago.
Books, when teams are drafting at the top and there's two players that, you know, I think are both special in Demidov and Levchinov, right? But one's a forward. And, you know, the history of NHL drafts tell us you pick a forward in the top five, you pick a defender in the top five. There's a lot less risk with the forward. How do you weight that if you're in a spot like the Chicago Blackhawks are? Do you at all as an amateur staff?
Well, that's interesting, and that is true. There's no question. The runway for a defenseman, no matter how good you are, is a couple of hundred games at least at the NHL level before you start to become the best version of yourself in the league. Forwards obviously have, and if you're a winger, you have less responsibility. So that's certainly something that that can be a talking point more than anything. I think for me, you just can't teach offense the way that Demidov can produce offense. It's not something that has to be coached up. It's just such a natural ability that is hard to find. And I'm not discounting the right shot D isn't hard to find because, oh my God, every trade deadline, we're all jumping over each other trying to get right shot D. So, you know, I'm splitting hairs. I don't have a right answer for your question, but it is a really fascinating one because one certainly involves more patience than the other, and that's the fact that the defenseman takes longer.
Does the draft, you know, sometimes it's like the draft really begins at five because we have a good sense of exactly where it's going to go, you know, with the first several picks. Where does the draft start? Does it start at two this year?
I think it starts at two in terms of a name coming off the board. Where it gets really interesting is as early as four, depending what Don Waddell, who's newly arrived in Columbus, wants to do with that pick. My gut tells me he's probably going to go for a Rick Nash type, like a Caden Lindstrom, if you will. But then when you get the five guys, now we're getting really interesting. Montreal is going to draft the forward. They've just got way too many defensemen in their system and really good ones, too. So they're flush there. I believe that they'll probably have three, maybe four names sitting on their list at five. If Lindstrom's gone, maybe that's only three names, for example. But they might be comfortable enough to trade back to, say, nine even with Calgary, and that would be an interesting scenario, wouldn't it? Because I think the Flames would obviously draft a Ginla. So time will tell, but certainly the most movement is in my mind, going to start at five.
And, you know, for teams in that 2 to 5 range, right, as Drant said, like a lot of times it feels like at this stage, you know, roughly 48 hours ahead of the draft, we have a pretty good idea of who's going, like who teams are really zeroing in on. It doesn't really feel like that this year. At this stage, again, a couple days before it starts, you know, we know the scouts, they've done so many meetings and had so many conversations, so many debates. How much uncertainty is there? Like, how much work is there left to be done? If you're Chicago, for example, do they have it written in stone already, or are they still debating and trying to figure out who they're going to take at number two on Friday?
No, they're going to debate it right to the end. I mean, it actually feels a little bit similar to, you know, when we drafted Barkov in New Jersey back in the day. Like, we had at that time Barkov, Drouin, and Seth Jones coming in. You know, obviously we did what we did. McKinnon was going to go one, but it feels like that a little bit too. So they're gonna have a lot of meetings still, and they're gonna be calling these kids in. I mean, I was speaking to Dan Milstein this morning. Like, Demidov has 20 interviews with teams here, starting yesterday and today. 20 interviews. I'm thinking, like, holy crap! So is somebody trading up to two or three? Because there's no way he's getting past three, and so that tells you right there that there's a lot of considerations being bantied about behind the scenes.
Yeah, it also seems like a lot of reporting about almost every team in the top 10 is, like, willing to move their pick. What does that say about the draft class, the fact that there's been so much, you know, and more than the usual, like, I mean, we're used to the this team's considering trading down, sort of, you know, gobbledygook, but this feels different.
It does feel different to me. It feels to me like there's a little bit of gamesmanship being thrown out there too, I have to say. But I believe that everybody starting at five is going to pick up. I think the phone is going to ring starting at four for everybody. There's going to be phone calls at four, and every team, all the way down to maybe even Detroit at, I believe, 15. Yeah, 15 for Detroit. I think there's going to be a lot of phone calls being made. And you know, if you have multiple picks in this draft, you might get over aggressive because of the fact that the depth of this class isn't as good as others, and you might be able to, you know, convince somebody to take you know, a girth of picks later on, you know, including obviously your early one, to make something happen. So I don't know, there's going to be a time limit on how long we can be there in round one, obviously, but it's going to be exciting. There's going to be, I think, a lot of phone calls being had.
So I always like to ask before the draft, especially when we have you on, Books, and you know how much work you put into evaluating the draft classes. Is there a guy that you think is likely to slip out of the top 10 that you think teams are really going to regret passing on in a few years? The Zach Benson Memorial.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, the Zach Benson Memorial Award. Yeah. Because there's so much parity after eight, like, I can see it. Let me put it to you this way. I think that there's more likelihood of somebody like Detroit shocking everybody, similar to what happened in Vancouver. Not shocking everybody in Vancouver, but when they took Sider, sixth overall in the draft, like, I can see them stepping up and taking Stein Solberg, the Norwegian defenseman, as early as 15. And that would really, you know, change a lot of people's list or shuffle the deck, if you will. As far as dropping out of the top 10, you know, I don't really see it, guys. I see Yzerman, maybe. There might be a team that likes him enough that they still believe in what he can do goal scoring wise, and he slides into the top 10. But again, it's too close to call that way.
For the Vancouver Canucks, who don't make their first selection at the NHL draft until pick number 93, How do you, as an amateur staff, adjust what you're looking for to make sure that this is, you know, still a worthwhile exercise?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm going to follow the strategy provided to me by the general manager, and that is that when you start drafting that late in the draft, are we looking at, you know, best player available on our list, or are we looking to draft for some need? And what's our timeline on that need, you know, in relation to our depth charts? Like if it's a European, you know, obviously we got 4 years on them. If it's a major junior guy and you draft them in the middle of the draft like that, you've only got a couple of years. There's a little bit more risk that way. But again, it just comes down to, what do we want? Is it best player? Are we drafting for need? But you better be on it, because the NHL and the cap world that we live in, you absolutely, as a staff, you have to find players at least every other year in the middle of the draft that become NHL players, because it assists with the development and assists with the timeline with the way you spend your money.
Jason, of course, one of the other highlights always of the draft is it's not just, you know, the guys getting picked and potentially, you know, teams moving around the board with their picks. It's the trades that can go down. And I think this year, especially with the increased salary cap space out there, you know, we saw Detroit kind of make a move to free up some extra space. Obviously, we know here the Canucks have a lot of flexibility. There's other teams out there with a lot of cap space to play with. What's your sense of how much trade activity there could be at this year's draft?
I think there's going to be a lot. I really do. I think that, and I mean, if you look at the Detroit trade, guys, like, they had to include a second round pick to unload Wallman's money. Like, we're talking Jake Wallman here. Like, no disrespect, but, you know, like, that's pretty rich, isn't it? So, I think that right there sets the market for the week. And you can only imagine if a big name like a Marner were to get moved, for example, you know, what the associated cost of such a deal would be, or even, you know, if Winnipeg, you know, end up having to move Rector McGordy, you know, there's lots of talk about that. Like, what's the cost association going to be in regard to moving a former first rounder like that as well? Because you look at when Cutter Gauthier went from Philly to Anaheim, you know, Drysdale was involved in the second rounder in 2025. So yeah, lots of moving parts. I think there's going to be roster players in play, and that's not the way it is every year.
And on McGroarty, as you mentioned there, you know, the with the reports that the Jets are probably going to have to trade him, he doesn't want to sign there. Give us a scouting report on McGroarty and how he's and how he's kind of developed since being the 14th overall pick a couple of years ago.
McGroarty is a heavy set player. You know, he does his best work coming off the half wall, net front, for example. Hockey IQ is really reliable, so he can kill penalties. Like, he's capable of that between the ears. The issue with Rucker is that he's an average skater. So, you know, he's not a burner between the blue lines, and he's not a guy. So if you do have him on the penalty kill and you get trapped in your zone for more than, call it, 30 seconds, you know, his breakdown is pretty evident, if you will. Like, it becomes an issue, his feet. So, you know, I don't want to say he's Zach Hyman, but he's Zach Hyman-like, if you get my drift. He's not a great skater, but he goes to the heavy areas, and he's been a really productive college player and at the World Juniors. So I still call him a grade-A prospect. He's got top six upside, but think Brock Besser a little bit when you think about the skating. So he's got to be on all the time in order to be productive when he gets to the NHL.
With the McGroarty development and the Cutter Gauthier trade, as you sort of brought up earlier for Drysdale, are we going to see a shift at all earlier in drafts in terms of how teams weight the signing risk of NCAA or U.S. national development team guys?
I'm curious to see what the trickle-down effect of this is. Absolutely. I mean, you know, when a team wins a Stanley Cup, guys, teams try and copy it. It's like a copycat lead that way. You know, like, oh, they did this well, we got to build our team that way. So when you see U.S. national team development programs or college kids, any college kids for that matter, that are starting to play this card, especially when they're first-round picks, you're going to have a longer conversation at the risk involved in picking them. You know, it never used to be like that. It used to be, you know, is a Russian going to come over, for example, right? Like, is Demidov going to come over after his contract expires next year? Now you're getting into a conversation where somebody that you just drafted in 2 years ago from the U.S. national team program doesn't want to sign with you, and that's a problem. So if you're splitting hairs between player A and player B, that conversation is going to be more intense now.
On the Canucks front, Jason, and you know, we're still waiting to see what's going to happen with all of their UFAs that they have, right? Tyler Myers, Nikita Zadorov, Dakota Joshua. And one of the things Drance and I have been talking about is with Joshua, there could be some serious sticker shock there when he signs his deal, whether it's with the Canucks or somewhere else. But you also look at the way he kind of increased his role in the playoffs. He was playing top six for them. And if you think he's a legitimate top six player, then all of a sudden the number he signs doesn't look so bad or won't look so so surprising. Do you see legitimate, you know, top six on a contender potential in Dakota Joshua?
No, I see spot duty top six. I think he's a middle six. I'm comfortable with him being a middle six. I don't see him being top six all year long. But I do see it in spot duty, and I also see him being able to match up on the road, you know, maybe in those top six moments a little bit more because he's heavy set and he gives us that element. There's going to be some sticker shock there. Absolutely, there's going to be. There's going to be a little bit of an overpayment. But the value that he doesn't provide necessarily compared to some other people will be making the same money statistically offensively. Which I think there is another level for him to go there offensively too, but it's not going to be extreme. But the value of him in playoffs, you know, with the way he plays the game, you have to pay for that. You have to make the investment. So, hey, is that contract going to start with a four in my world? I'd have to be talked into it, to be honest with you. But I don't know what the market is going to suggest. So, you know, the Canucks are a better team keeping him than having him walk out the door. I'll tell you that because he's a hard player to find to replace for the role.
Yeah, that uniqueness, Books, and I've been talking about this for a long time. Like, he feels like a player that's just ripe for a bidding war to ensue because there's kind of no one else like him.
That's it. He's a unicorn to me. I mean, you know, like, the league, especially between games 1 and 82, isn't a heavy league anymore. Like, it is at times, but, you know, it's a track meet for the most part, right, guys? And so he can play that way, but, you know, I always go back to that night in New Jersey when he came out of the lineup after the fight, you know, and he went on, he was out of the lineup for a stretch there. the value of him in the on the roster, it stood out even more for me during that period of time. So, you know, I'd rather see an overpayment on him, not obscene, like not, mm-hmm. you know, not $5 million a year, but I'd rather see a little bit of an overpayment on him than a risk reward coming back with a player that only plays one way.
It's going to be fascinating to see. They've got a lot of big decisions to make here. As we said, don't pick until the third round in the draft, but could still be a very, very interesting few days for the Canucks. Books, enjoy Vegas. Enjoy the Sphere, man. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, guys. Thanks for having me on, Jay. And, you know, Drancer, take care of yourself there.
I will. I will. Don't drink too much without me, bud.
No, that's not happening. I got a red eye getting out of here on Saturday for free agency on Monday. So I'm just trying to stay hydrated a different way.
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
All right, boys. We'll see you.
That is Jason Buchla from Sportsnet's NHL coverage.
That is Jason Buchla mixing in a water.
Yes, mixing in a lot of waters, hopefully, especially with that heat down there, man. But from Sportsnet's NHL coverage and a former NHL scout weighing in on what he's looking for at the draft, who's going to go second. And I did just see, by the way, while we were having that conversation, a tweet from your Athletic colleague, Pierre LeBrun, saying Chicago is getting calls from teams on the second overall pick, but they're telling everyone that they are going to keep the pick. So we'll see what they decide to do, whether it's Demidov or Lifshunov with the number two overall pick from the Chicago Blackhawks. Yeah, I you were saying just in general, it feels like there's more uncertainty. And for me, I have been so tuned out of draft because it's just been so off our radar. They don't pick till the third round. They were in the playoffs. Like, you could tell me any order. I'm like, I don't know. Is that guy even real? Who knows? Oh, he's going to be the eighth overall pick? Sure. I guess we'll see. I have absolutely no sense for how it's going to go.
There's like that there's that Calgary WHL defenseman.
Yakimchuk? Carter Yakimchuk?
Yeah.
Yes.
Not we'll need to see proof of actual like life there.
I love when Books was like, they could take that Norwegian defenseman. I was like, oh yeah, of course. That would be really surprising. That high, really? At 15? Wow. I had no idea he was gonna go that high. Okay, we got one more segment coming up here. So get your texts in. Lots of thoughts coming in. We'll read some of them on the other side. By the way, NHL draft coverage is brought to you by Oxygen Yoga and Fitness, not your typical yoga studio. And you will be able to hear round one, I think, for sure. Although, of course, the Canucks don't pick, so it might be in and out. But round one coverage, and then, of course, rounds 2 through 7 will be on Sportsnet 650. So make sure you tune in here for your draft coverage. Final segment of Canucks Talk coming up next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with 3 stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Get your texts in now. And I like it. Our listeners are really getting creative here, Drancer, right? Like, this is prime, you know, second really only to the lead up to the trade deadline. And maybe this even trumps the trade deadline because there's not even games happening. It's just now pure speculation until things get going at the draft and then free agency. You know, this is prime send in your proposals. Prime silly season. Trade ideas, all that, right?
Prime all your trade ideas second. Here's
exactly,
why.
Exactly. But I like that we're not just getting normal. We're not getting like the updated version of Ballard Raymond in a second for a star player here. Like, our listeners are getting creative, and
are
I appreciate
they?
That.
Like, their trade proposals do not suck?
Well, I don't know about that. Oh. But at least it's like we're starting to think about like retention and, you know, like all of these things. We're getting into it here.
Someone made me think with the Lyonnais Mikheyev.
Well, proposal. And this is along those same lines. So it's Sagan. Tyler Sagan has 3 more years at 9.85 AAV. Do you think Dallas would be looking to offload his contract, and should the Canucks be interested? Mikheyev going the other way. So you're offsetting some of the money that you're taking back on Tyler Sagan,
and they're getting out from a year of term, they're opening up some salary cap flexibility.
Isn't Sagan like eight?
I think he's more than that.
Yeah, he's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you take on an extra year.
Mm-hmm.
No.
What if they're sending a pick? What if Dallas is giving you a pick?
How good a pick? A first round pick?
Is that what it would have to be?
At least. Like, Sagan's a third liner. Like, he's a middle six guy now.
Yeah, he's good, a middle six guy.
He's a good middle six guy. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, and credit to him, right? Like, the injury that he had and the work that he had to do to strengthen one side of his body to get back to even being that is, like, through the roof impressive, right? Like, honestly, like, kudos, mad respect. I always loved watching Sagan operate at the left circle in his younger days in Dallas. That you know, early, like, Lindy Ruff Dallas Stars team when they had the bright green, and it was new, and, you know, him and Jamie Benn, and they were one of the most, Louis Erickson, they were one of the most exciting teams in the sport. Big fan of his game, and the work that he's done to remain playable is wildly impressive. Like, honestly, one of the most impressive, given the extent of his injury and the extent of working back from it, honestly, one of the most impressive individual performances probably in the league of the last couple of years. But, I mean, what? So did you find out what the actual number is? It's like 9.5, right?
It is 9.85. I think the listener had it right, 9.85.
Okay, so why would the Canucks be doing 9.85 for a middle six guy when Mikheyev's 4.75 for a middle six guy with one less year of term? Even if Sagan scores more, like, you know, that far exceeds my risk.
And I think it's similar to me to the, like, David Perron conversation we were having, right? Where he doesn't move the needle enough to be worth all of the downsides that we're talking about here, right? But again, I also think that it might get to the point where you have to start considering some fairly outside the box things, right? And some things that at first blush, maybe you're like, oh, I'm not crazy about that player at that price. But if there is retention, if there are picks coming back, things like that, then all of a sudden maybe it makes sense. And the text you were referring to earlier was from Keith the Water Guy, who said that given that Detroit has set the price of a second rounder for a $3.5 million player, would you trade Mikheyev for Line A and a second if Columbus would retain, give Line A a $7.5 million cap hit for 2 years? That's from Keith the Water Guy. And even you, prime Patrick Line A hater, had to stop and think about that one for a second.
I'm not a hater. I just don't believe in it.
I just hate his game.
He's not the bet I think the Canucks should place, like, for all the talk it reasons we've discussed. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just not buying it in Vancouver. But yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one where it's like, if you get paid to take on something like that and you're adding, now I don't think you probably get the retention if you're getting a pick and
right and giving them Mikheyev.
Yeah, but yeah. But you know, I look, that one's interesting. I wish you could apply the concept to like a different distressed asset, you know.
Yeah, I get that, but the thing is, like, assets become distressed for a reason, you know what I mean? There's no perfect distressed asset, because then they wouldn't be distressed.
No, but there's bets you want to make.
Sure.
Like, last year, when Garland and Besser were distressed assets, those are bets that I thought the Canucks should hold on and make. Tyler Myers. I described Tyler Myers for years as a hold, right? Because I thought that he'd resuscitate his value in the final year of his deal, just given the uniqueness of his profile. I didn't expect him necessarily to have, like, his best Canucks season at 34. I just thought he can't possibly play like this, given, you know, who he is, and that his value would spike as sort of the term on his deal went low. Those were bets that I thought you should place, right? I'm not someone who's betting on a Mikheyev bounce back. You know, like, I believe that his speed will return. I think there's a chance he even becomes something closer to the, like, bottom six driver that he was in Toronto, but I don't buy that the offense is, like, I don't know that one goal in 61 games is who Mikheyev is. It probably should be, like, four.
Yep.
Four or five or six, but I also don't think he's a reliable 20 goal guy who you really should have complementing skill players. So, like, that's not a bet that personally I think the Canucks should make. I don't think that's a hold. I think that's one where you maybe want to consider cutting your losses. And Line A is just not a distressed asset that I recommend betting on. from a Canucks perspective.
Yeah, that's understandable. Again, I think once you start to talk about getting picks back and things like that, there's a lot more guys that I'm willing to take that bet on. Again, as like plan C here, right? Yeah. Not as, hey, that's the first thing we're going to go out and do with our cap space and all of that, but at least as options, if your first choices don't work out. More text coming in about offseason plans, offseason targets here. Dan from North Van texted in, who would be a low cost top six winger option? He throws out some names like Tomas Tatar, Jeff Skinner, he includes Dominik Kubalík. I think Jason Zucker is a name that comes to mind for me, right? As we just kind of think of targets they were interested in, or we heard reported interest at the trade deadline. Obviously, they have a history of Zucker as well.
I don't think there's much there at the moment, though.
Yeah, fair enough.
So we'll see. Of those names mentioned, Kubalík would be the only one. Like, I don't think Tatar has the foot speed to play Canucks hockey. Skinner, he mentioned Skinner.
Yeah,
I like Skinner. I think maybe he could do it. It's not a perfect fit, but maybe. But Kubalík like has the size and the assertiveness, I think, to actually play Rick Tocchet hockey.
Mm-hmm.
But man, he's really struggled for a couple of years, and I don't really understand why. He's just a guy who has like, I have a soft spot for like lanky, disruptive wingers.
Mm-hmm.
I it's a template we've just like seen work time and time again. And we've even seen like lanky centers who aren't really centers, but get moved to wing. Succeed in the right situation, you know, scoring off the rush with a big body like Sean Matthias in that 1 year in Vancouver, a guy who sort of fits that template. Kubalík strikes me as a guy who should be able to do those sorts of things, but I don't know exactly why it hasn't worked for him for the last 2 years, because I liked him like in Chicago. I liked him when Chicago beat Edmonton in the bubble. I was at those games and I was like, oh yeah, this guy, you know, does some of that like poor man's prime James Van Riemsdyk stuff that, you know, I could see a team really gambling on.
Yeah, I mean, he did have 20 goals year before last with Detroit.
Yeah, but his defensive game was brutal.
And I do think, you know, he has that 30-goal season on his resume when he broke in with Chicago, which is the year you're talking about.
It
ended with the bubble. And that's been his high watermark, and he hasn't kind of really lived up to that since then. I think if you're talking about, like, guy who's still on the market late July and early August, and you're not penciling him in, but as you talk about, like, place some upside bets, and if he's one of a couple of guys in that mold that you bring in to at least give you some depth scoring, maybe, hey, if it all pops and he is playing Rick Tocchet hockey, he can be a top six option for you. I think that's actually a pretty interesting name because of the size, because of the goal scoring track record to watch.
Yeah, I could see him being a pretty disruptive F1 type, like, you know, not that I'd want to bet on him being a Joshua replacement, but like some of those traits. Without necessarily the same commitment or consistency in terms of the heaviness that he brings, at least he's got some of those traits, which, you know, I'd be interested in seeing what that looks like. You know, if the Canucks believe in the player on an affordable 1 year.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's an interesting one to watch.
I've got time for that, provided that there's no opportunity cost associated with it.
Yes, and you're not, obviously. Yeah, I think he feels like somebody where opinion around the league has decreased sufficiently that there's a good chance he would be available at a pretty low cost and potentially later on into the summer, because it feels like people are quite low on him. As you said, he's struggled, especially defensively and then goal scoring as well last year for the last couple of seasons. Somebody else texting in about Daniel Sprong in that category. I don't know how cheap Daniel Sprong is going to be. 46 and 43 points the last couple of years. Sprong was drafted by Pittsburgh, I believe, when Jim Rutherford was there, but he was also traded away from Pittsburgh, so I don't know if they see necessarily a fit. I mean, he's got the shooting capability for sure. I also just I don't know how cheap Daniel Sprong is going to be as an unrestricted free agent, so I think if you're looking for that kind of true buy low, low-cost option to plug into the top six, I'm not sure he's even going to fit the bill necessarily.
Guy's just super fun.
Like, great shooter.
Daniel Sprong's just fun as heck. Daniel Sprong, 3-on-1. He's in the worst angle. Let's say he's going down the right sides let's say he's going down the left side of the ice too. Mm-hmm. So both Pettersson and JT Miller are one-time options, right? Defender is down and out. Daniel Sprong's decision tree, right?
Shoot, 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 shoot.
Who's the best option? It's me! That's what I love about Daniel Sprong. And he's like not wrong most of the time.
That's what you love about Daniel Sprong. That's what probably a lot of coaches do not like about Daniel Sprong necessarily.
You have to know what you're getting with Daniel Sprong, and what you're getting is a guy who is so convinced that he's like the best. His shot is the best one on the decision tree at any given moment, and usually he's right, and it's awesome. It's just like rock star stuff, you know? Like he's got like the irrational confidence game down pat. Big fan. Not sure he's like the ideal Rick Tocchet player, but he is an elite, like truly one of the five or six best one-shot goal scorers in hockey. It's just that, you know, there's not a lot else to his game.
It does seem like you love him if you're bringing him in cheap and he's kind of down your roster, your lineup, but you can move him up if you need to. But if you're bringing him in and like, all right, he's one of our first choice top six forwards, that's probably not a great sign about where your team is, right? And I feel like his price point isn't going to be necessarily right for the bottom of the roster, but can move up when needed type of player. But he is a lot of fun to watch.
He rules. Is a blast. He rules.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Nice guy Ty texts in. What about trade for anyone from Vegas if they want to make space for Jake Guentzel? That's an interesting one. If you assume, and I think it's a fair assumption at this point, that any high profile star player out there that Vegas could potentially be interested in them and willing to try to do things to make it happen, is there a player on Vegas that they would move to clear salary that the Canucks would potentially be interested in? Just looking at their salary cap sheet right now.
All of them.
I mean, one name jumps out in particular.
Who?
Ivan Barbashev.
Yeah.
Wasn't he like prime potential UFA target for the Canucks going into last summer, except he signed to stay with Vegas after winning the cup there?
Yep. And I mean, he's awesome.
He's awesome.
Big fan.
William Karlsson. I don't think he would be their first choice to trade, but I mean, they traded Riley Smith after they won the cup. So they're clearly not shy about dealing guys. But I think if Ivan Barbashev was on the market, then yeah, you absolutely consider doing that. Now, he has got some no trade protection, but he's also a Dan Milstein client, so you got to think there'd be a way to make that work, given the relationship between Dan Milstein and the Canucks front office. But I do think that's an interesting, just in general, kind of backup plan is, if teams are so motivated to spend, yes, there's extra cap space out there, but that doesn't mean everyone can just, you know, give Jake Guentzel a blank check and do whatever they want. There's still going to be teams that need to clear cap space.
So they're going to lose Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
That's like pretty much done. Fait accompli. An interesting name, by the way. Like a guy that I think would be a really interesting gamble depending on where his market goes. He really struggled last season defensively, but he was coming off of injury, and at the end of the day he was struggling, but he was also still playing top of the lineup minutes with Alex Pietrangelo.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I'd be really curious to know if there's a final act of Alec Martinez's career where he's deployed like Ian Cole, you know, and kind of gets back to the sorts of results that he managed throughout his, you know, incredibly storied professional hockey career. That's a guy with weight, a guy who's won a lot, one of the most popular teammates in the NHL. Like, honestly, guys love this dude. That to me is, but they have the other guy. Who's their other big defenseman who's got like a relatively big ticket?
Nick Waugh?
No, that's the center.
Oh, sorry. Nick Hag.
No, that guy they're not trading. He's awesome. I'm talking about, is it McNabb?
McNabb's on 2.8. Yeah.
So not huge.
White
but
Clouds, four more years at 2.75.
And I love White Cloud.
Right shot defenseman, 4 years of that cost certainty.
I think he could do some of the play with Hughes stuff too.
That's interesting. He's got some size.
Yeah.
I mean, if White, like, is that enough though? Like, is that enough for them to go out and sign Jake Guentzel? He's only 2.75. That's the thing. Like, that's such a team-friendly contract. I don't know if that's where they're looking to try to clear salary cap space.
No,
but it's a really interesting name.
Yeah, I mean, look, Vegas only has good players. So if they make...
Just take anyone!
If they make any of those good players available, yeah, you should get in line. Hand out. Let's go.
Somebody else texted in along those lines. Raph in the Valley, it was. How about Cirelli or Chernak out of Tampa? Tampa's so fascinating to me, right? Obviously, they've got Steven Stamkos, you know, franchise icon, captain of the team, all of that, who's an unrestricted free agent. We've been through this song and dance with Stamkos and the Tampa Bay Lightning before, where it feels like he's going to go elsewhere, and then he signs and he stays there. It's not a straightforward path, though, with their cap space to make it happen, right? I know they've got, I think they still have some LTIR candidates, or maybe not, actually, at this point, but it's not a straightforward path. And the fascinating thing about Tampa is the guys that they would have to clear or trade are, one, really good, and also signed for really long term, right? Like, it is Anthony Cirelli, it is Brandon Hagel, it is Eric Chernak. There's almost nobody on that team that makes an appreciable amount of money that isn't signed for like 6 or 7 or 8 years. So Tampa, I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, maybe Stamkos is going to go elsewhere. We saw Detroit make that trade, and obviously the Stevie Y connection with Stamkos. Could that be a potential landing spot? But it does feel like Tampa's going to have to do something if they want to keep Steven Stamkos in. And if it never did mean they had to shake things up to the level the texture is suggesting. I mean, I think both of those players, especially, I love Cirelli's game in particular. Like, I think that would be fascinating. Brandon Hagel will be really interesting as well as a 25-year-old signed long-term. But I just don't see them, those guys shaking loose.
Well, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember the story in the industry. I don't remember how much of this was actually reported, but I think some of it was where in the expansion round to Seattle, right? He'd been, at least there was an exploration about him waiving his NMC.
Stamkos?
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me.
So I don't know that the, like, I think Tampa would keep him because he's so vital to their culture and on, but I just don't. I've never really gotten the sense that they're operating in a way where they trade like guys in their mid-20s.
To keep Stamkos.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And those are like, that's what it would have to be. Maybe there's another rabbit they pull out of their hat. It wouldn't shock me. They're a really smart organization. They're a really creative organization. But you just try to find, there's no obvious like, oh, that guy's 31 and he's making $5 million when he should be making $3 million. That's who we're going to trade in order to sign Steven Stamkos. There's no clear option like that. So whatever they do, it's going to have to be pretty creative to figure out a way to get it done with Steven Stamkos. 650, just tons. Some people are so fired up for the beginning of free agency.
And as they should be. Well, and the Canucks right now, too, are like absolutely the gang member in The Simpsons just standing there. And we're like, hey, like, this team has 7 or 8 key pending UFAs. They have $20 million in cap space. They're a team that I think has ambitions to get from knocking on the door to busting it down. Mm-hmm. And they have this characteristically aggressive front office. Like, I don't want to go inside yet. This team's going to do something. And to this point, it's just so quiet.
And plus, there's also nothing. You can dream up pretty much anything at this point because they have the salary cap space to do it.
Yeah.
Right? They have the salary cap space in addition to the factors you're mentioning, right? The aggression of the front office, even like trade assets if they wanted to go down that path. Not a ton of them, but at least enough to do something fairly big if they wanted to do that. And then it just, again, there's no player that you can dream up and say, oh, well, they can't do that for cap reasons. Right? Like, they can do anything. They might have to make some compromises at other spots on the roster once they do it, but there's basically any player in the league is on the table for them.
Provided that they'll take their money.
Yes, which is always a question in unrestricted free agency. But I get why people are so fired up because,
heck yeah,
one, I think there's a high level of confidence, understandably, in how this management group is going to spend that money in free agency. And then there's just so many options on the table for this team just a few days out from July 1st. Some other names that people are throwing out there. What about J.G. Pageau if he gets bought out from the Islanders?
I don't think he'd get bought out, but I do wonder about that as the Mikheyev destination. I think there's this sense of like connecting Mikheyev to Pittsburgh all the time because of Dubas. But Mikheyev signed that deal when Lou Lamoriello was GM. And that Jim Palfolito guy, the guy who brought in Zaitsev and Mikheyev, he ran on a heater of bringing over like useful depth players for absolute free from Russia for a bit. He's now working in on the island as well. So to me, that would be like more the Pageau thing. I'd be pretty surprised. Something's got to give cap wise for the Islanders. Don't get me wrong.
You would think so.
But I would be pretty surprised if it was a Pageau buyout. Like, that's not Lamoriello's style. Is not that it doesn't match with Lamoriello's style. Like, this is a guy who exhausts all other options as opposed to you know, fixing dead cap money. Like, he just waits. He's patient. You know, I can't even remember the last time he's bought out a guy. So I'd be surprised by that.
Yes, I'd be maybe by the buyout, but I do think as a target in like a Mikheyev swap, I can see it making a lot of sense.
Yeah,
two years left at $5 million, so just a hair more than Mikheyev makes for a center.
And he was okay last year. The Islanders were just so bad 5-on-5 as a team. Anytime Bo Horvat wasn't on the ice, they were such a train wreck. And you know, I think I'm a little scarred by that in my Pageau evaluation, because like all I remember is like, you know, Quinn Hughes legitimately made him like the intro scene to a 6 Feet Under episode in that game on Long Island. You remember that goal where Quinn Hughes like spun off him twice?
Yeah. Yes.
And it was like an and one mixtape. Like he literally was like 6 feet underground after that move. And then Hughes just kind of scored like a William Nylander high or like a wrist shot goal from middle distance. It's unfortunate because I saw it live and I was like, woof. But, you know, getting deked out by Quinn Hughes doesn't mean much. Like, that can happen to anybody. That can happen to Barkov.
Yeah, Quinn Hughes is really good.
Yeah.
And
what I'm saying.
If you're looking for a guy to be your third line center, potentially, like, okay, yeah, you got burned by Quinn Hughes once.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's not a fair thing, yes. But in my mind's eye, like, just, like, watching that in real time and being like, I'm, like, just really enjoying it. And then, like, watching it 18 times on the replay. Just like occupies too much mental space for me.
All right. We'll wrap it up here today. Thank you for all the texts. Thank you for all the creative ideas and the suggestions. A lot of fun to go through them. A lot of fun to try to predict, try to think what might happen just a few days away. So we will continue the speculation, the rumor mongering, the reading the tea leaves and all of that on the show tomorrow. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.